Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. As I mentioned last week, de Waal gives us a very lucid picture of how the Euphrosi family continued to live, notwithstanding the war. Elizabeth is now a young woman and regularly goes to the opera with Mama and Papa or in the company of her cousins. She makes notes of all the operas attended and is particularly keen on Wagner's music and very patriotically underlines Deutsch by the German master's works. The younger children are taken to the war exhibition at the Prater. They are effectively Austrian and deeply patriotic, but they are confused as at school and in the streets they hear of British envy, French thirst for revenge, and Russian rapacity. They have dear cousins, aunts, uncles in England, France, Russia, but they can no longer visit them and share holiday periods with them. In summer, they cannot go to the Chalet Euphrosi in Lucerne, so the children spend all the summer months in Kovacek's, where at least the agricultural produce is plentiful, unlike back in the capital, where food is scarce. Victor's effort at running the bank is harder than ever. All his competent collaborators have been called up. Patriotically, he is generous in supporting the war effort, and patriotically, he chooses not to take his friend's advice to move his money to Switzerland. At home, he spends much time in his beloved library, and he sorely misses the excitement of opening bundles of books arriving from Petersburg, Paris, London, Florence. Matters between him and Emmy are not so good. The corridor between Emmy's dressing room, the room with the netsuke, and Victor's dressing room seems to get longer and longer. Before the war, every summer the glass roof over the courtyard used to be cleaned. Now, for lack of servants, the glass over the Euphrosi Palace courtyard has not been cleaned for 2 years. The light coming in is greyer than ever before. And grey is the future. On 21st November 1916, Franz Josef dies. He was 86 years old and had been on the throne since 1848. There follows a brief but very clear account of the massive funeral cortege through the streets of Vienna lined with soldiers. The hearse is pulled by 8 horses with black plumes, followed by the young new emperor Karl, his wife Zita, and their 4-year-old son Otto, wearing white with a black sash. Present for the funeral mass are the kings of Bulgaria, Bavaria, Saxony and Wittenberg, 50 archdukes and archduchesses, and 40 other princes and princesses. The somber cortege makes its way to the Kapuziner Kirche, where the dead emperor will be laid in the Kaisergruft, the imperial crypt. De Waal briefly mentions the drama of admittance to the church when the guards knock thrice and are twice refused entrance by the monks. Then Franz Josef is laid down between his wife Elizabeth and his long-dead son, the suicide Rudolf.
According to the will of the Holy Roman Empress Anna, a crypt was to be built under the existing Capuchin church in the heart of Vienna. The Empress died in 1618 and was buried in a simple vault beneath the church, where in the following year she was joined by her cousin and husband, the Emperor Matthias. Work on the Kapuziner Gruft, or Capuchin Crypt, was commenced in 1632, and the first burials were those of the imperial couple. During the following centuries, the crypt was enlarged and extended, and in it are buried the remains of nearly 200 members of the Habsburg and Habsburg-Lorraine family. The Viennese branch of the Efrusi family must have been familiar with the place, and most likely some of them witnessed the funeral procession of what was to be the very last burial of a sovereign who passed on his throne to a descendant. This was the burial of Emperor Franz Josef, who died on the 21st of November 1916. He was 86 and had reigned for 68 years, less 11 days. There was a particularly interesting ritual when a burial took place. Once the cortege reached the Capuchin Church, the imperial master of ceremonies would knock at the closed church door, behind which the prior would be waiting. Asking who was knocking at the door, the master of ceremonies would announce the name and full titles of the late Habsburg seeking burial. In the case of Franz Josef, the master of ceremonies responded thus: "It is His Imperial and Royal Majesty Franz Josef, Emperor of Austria, Apostolic King of Hungary, of Bohemia, Croatia, Slavonia, Galicia, Lodomeria and Illyria, King of Jerusalem and so on, Archduke of Austria, Grand Duke of Tuscany and Krakow, Duke of Lorraine, Salzburg, Carniola, Carinthia and Bukovina, Grand Prince of Transylvania, Margrave of Moravia, Duke of Modena, Parma, Piacenza and Guastalla, Friuli, Ragusa and Zara, Sovereign of the Order of the Golden Fleece," and at least 23 other titles. There would be no response from the Capuchin prior, so the ritual continued, but this time the Imperial Master of Ceremonies saying that it was His Imperial and Royal Majesty Franz Josef. No response again. So at the third knock at the door, the Master of Ceremonies replied, "It is Franz Josef of Habsburg-Lorraine, humbly seeking admission," at which the door would open and let in the supplicant. Despite all the pomp, pageantry and splendor, this was a reminder that death is the ultimate leveler everybody, high and low, has to reckon with. Ironically, the last Habsburg Emperor King, Karl, who died in exile in Madeira and was beatified by Pope John Paul II in 2004, is still buried on that Portuguese island, while his wife, Zita, and most of their children and other descendants are buried in the Kapuziner Gruft in Vienna.
It is 37 years since the Emperor Franz Josef ennobled Grandfather Ignaz. It is a generation since he opened the Ringstrasse, the Votivkirche, the Opera House, the City Hall, the Burgtheater. With the passing away of the old Emperor, the Jewish community lose their protector. They, however, reiterate their faithfulness to the Empire. It is said that the Jews are not only the most loyal supporters of the Empire, but the only unconditional Austrians. By spring 1917, thousands of soldiers desert their positions. Over 2 million are taken prisoner. Food is heavily rationed, and there is a wave of strikes, and of course there are demonstrations against the Jews. Elizabeth and her friend Fanny Lovenstein spend their summer 1917 holidays at the Baroness Oppenheimer's house, as also have the poet Hugo von Hofmannsthal and the composer Richard Strauss. Another guest is the historian Josef Redlich, who predicts the impending defeat of Austria-Germany. The girls are shocked as they still innocently place their trust in the optimistic official communiques.
After composing the opera Salome in 1905 and Elektra in 1908, Richard Strauss opted for a lighter change of pace with the opera Der Rosenkavalier, composed in 1910. Another collaboration with the famed playwright Hugo von Hofmannsthal. Based on a three-act libretto by Hofmannsthal, the opera is set in 18th century Vienna, during the time of Empress Maria Theresa. But the music of Der Rosenkavalier was inspired by the gaiety and grace of the Viennese waltz, a form which did not evolve until well over 100 years after her illustrious court. No matter, we are out to have fun. Moreover, this is a grand opera, which means that anything can happen and usually does. Like the fact that both the male and female leading roles are played by sopranos. As the work evolved, a fascinating correspondence developed between the collaborators in the early months of 1909, including a letter from Hofmannsthal to the composer on 11th February. I have spent 3 quiet afternoons here in making out a complete, quite fresh scenario for a Spiel opera. Gay, almost pantomimically transparent in its action, giving occasion for lyricism, jokes, humor, even a little ballet with 2 large roles for a baritone and graceful girl dressed as a man. On 12th May, Hofmannsthal added, "Your fear that the work might be too subtle does not cause me any anxiety. The course of the action is simple and intelligible by even the naivest audience. A fat, aging and arrogant suitor, for Sophie, rival to the Marshalin, favored by her father, is given his comeuppance by a young and handsome fellow, Octavian, the Rosencavalier, who is played by a woman. A crisis develops when the Marshalin, who is now in her mature years, realizes that she must give up her young lover to a girl of his own generation. As for the cast, Strauss had very clear ideas, noted in his later memoirs titled Recollections and Reflections. The Marshalin must be a young and beautiful woman of about 32, who, when she is in a bad mood, occasionally feels ancient compared to her paramour, the 17-year-old Octavian. Of course, Octavian is neither the first nor the last lover of the beautiful Marshalin, and she is not to play the end of the first act in a sentimental fashion, as a tragic farewell to life, but all the time with Viennese grace and lightness, half weeping, half smiling. After the opera's enormous success, Strauss extracted some of the great tunes into an orchestral suite, from which followed a variety of derivations by various arrangers and conductors. We shall be hearing some of the music from this suite in further editions of the program. All of the renditions are centered around the florid waltzes of the Rosencavalier. And in every setting, the music resounds with lusty tunes, swaggering rhythms, gorgeous harmonies and a scintillating orchestration, all in tribute to the great Viennese tradition. Wunderbar! Never would Elizabeth and her friend Fanny Lovenstein, fascinated by the musician and poet, have imagined that the end of the glamorous Austro-Hungarian Empire was so near.
In July 1917, Elizabeth receives her matriculation certificate. She is happy, notwithstanding that the world around her is crumbling. Her father is aging and is weighed down by responsibility. Her mother is pregnant again. On the 4th of November 1918, Austria signs the armistice with the Allies. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is dissolved on the 12th November. Emperor Karl and Empress Zita flee to Switzerland. Austria is now a republic. On November 19th, Emmy gives birth to her fourth child, and they call him Rudolf Josef, so elegiac a name for a little Jewish boy, just at the fall of the Habsburg Empire. There are rumors that the Efrusi are keeping up appearances. It is a known fact that Emmy has a bevy of lovers. But in all this, Elizabeth is victorious. She is registered at the Vienna University. She has made it from one side of the Ringstrasse to the other. She will be one of the few female students at Vienna University, and a Jewish female student to boot. Allow me again a brief interlude here, as I would like to mention that early in the 20th century, Malta University also admitted one of its first lady students, Ondina Tayar, who too was Jewish. Grey is the color of life now. Grey is the light that filters through the unwashed glass dome over the Palais Great Courtyard. Vienna is now reduced to being the hydrocephalic head of a shrunken body. The Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye in 1919 sanctioned the dismemberment of the empire. It sanctified the independence of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland and Yugoslavia, and the state of the Slovens, the Croats and the Serbs. Istria went, Trieste went, as did several Dalmatian islands. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is now a small state but 500 miles long. There were doubts as to whether the new state would at all be viable. There were, of course, the expected post-war repercussions. The victors imposed harsh and punitive conditions so hard that they would lead to renewed conflict within little more than 2 decades. With the Declaration of the Republic and a wave of communism coming from the East, all titles of nobility were abolished. Street names were changed, and those streets were crowded with jobless civil servants coming from all the corners of the empire, with crippled and shell-shocked soldiers, with captains and majors who helplessly resorted to selling wooden toys in street corners. Again, I ask for a few seconds for an interlude. The author here mentions the silent film The Joyless Street, in which a young Greta Garbo plays the part of the hungry daughter of a penniless, widowed pensioner, a civil servant. They live on a Vienna street where the crooked butcher dominates the lives of all the neighbors. This film expressed the life of the Viennese in those post-war years when the economy was in shambles and Vienna was invaded by hungry, homeless people looking for work, in much the same way as the Italian filmmakers Rossellini and De Sica did with the neorealist movies in post-World War II Italy. As always, in a situation of economic turmoil and mounting inflation, anti-Semitism gained ground. But it was not mentioned in the Efrusi household. If anything, it was taken rather lightly. Edmund Wall's uncle Iggy recounted that they laughed at the demonstrations against the plague of Eastern Jews, and at the mass displays of youth groups and their proud uniforms, and of Austrians in Dridel and Lederhosen. But the dark clouds were fast approaching. Inflation made one's possessions sink into a vacuum. In Victor's safe at the bank in Schottengasse, the stocks of deeds and bonds and share certificates are worthless. His assets in London and Paris were confiscated as part of the punitive peace settlement. His Russian fortune, the gold held in St. Petersburg, the shares in the Baku oil fields, the railways, the banks, the real estate in Odessa, all have disappeared. The patriot Victor Efrusi, who had refused to transfer his monies to Switzerland, who had invested massively in war bonds, now saw it all slipping away. Each part of Victor's world had closed down, even the vast fortune which had been promised to him by his childless cousin Jules in Paris could not, under the circumstances of war, be legated to him. And they went to the French cousins. Before the war, Victor had a fortune of 25 million crowns. Now his life in Odessa, St. Petersburg, Paris, and London was finished. Only the hydrocephalic palais on the Ringstrasse remained. they were not exactly destitute. But things now had to be preserved, even cherished. The uncounted and the unmeasured started to be counted very accurately. The heavy oak door of the Efrusi Palace, so diligently watched by the old doorman, has morally been breached. How will the inhabitants adapt? How will they fare? We shall see in the next week's episode. I am grateful to Albert Storace and to Gerald Fenech for their contributions to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.